Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 24th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. Tremendous weather Wednesday, strong to severe storm chances finish up the week. Some really pleasant weather is a break from the overall active weather pattern we've been enduring, but it doesn't last for too long. Clear skies are getting the vast majority of eastern Iowans on Wednesday, with some exceptions along the far eastern edge of the state. This is where low clouds have spread westward from the Great Lakes. The progress of these clouds will be limited, especially after sunrise. The clearer skies we're expecting helped temperatures fall toward a chilly range in the 30s and 40s, with some patchy frost possible this morning at the north end. Temperatures will experience a steady climb into the upper 50s to low 60s by afternoon. The most notable and welcomed feature of the weather day, much lighter winds. Speeds stay between 5 to 15 miles per hour from the northeast. Clouds will increase a little bit during Thursday, and winds will be a bit stronger from the southeast. This will help to push temperatures a bit higher, reaching into the mid to upper 60s after starting out in the upper 30s to 40s. That's Thursday morning. Showers and storms are likely to arrive as soon as Thursday night into Friday morning, as activity develops to our southwest and pushes into the area. The risk for severe weather with this round of activity is fairly low, with a few storms potentially containing a bit of small hail. Heavy downpours and frequent lightning are likely, though, and you should expect the potential for a wet commute to start out the last day of the work and school week. More showers and storms are likely as we go through the day, with another round set to develop again to our southwest and track northeast into eastern Iowa. This second round has the higher chance for storms that turn strong to severe. Large hail, damaging wind, and an isolated tornado are all possible as this moves in later in the day into early Friday night. Saturday should have at least part of the day to be a break from storm activity, likely lasting from the morning through the early portion of the afternoon, as the first area of low pressure moves away from us toward the Great Lakes. Trailing behind this low will be a frontal boundary that will become temporarily stationary across Iowa. Along and east of this front, new thunderstorm development is looking a little more likely again by Saturday afternoon and evening. Given the ability of the atmosphere to recharge some energy for storms to work with, the risk for strong to severe storms will again be present across most of the area. Damaging wind, a few tornadoes, and large hail again appear to be possible. More rounds of showers and storms look likely from later Saturday night through Sunday, as the second area of low pressure follows a very similar track to the first. Like Friday, at least a couple of rounds of activity appear possible, with the higher chance of strong to severe storms coming with the second round. Generally, plan on a wet day in the area, with some break between the two rounds in the late morning to early afternoon. The Storm Prediction Center has maintained its slight risk for severe storms on Sunday across much of eastern Iowa. This threat is still several days away, so there could be some adjustments to its placement in the coming days, as the timing of weather features in the fast-moving pattern is further refined. Looking at next week now, we should catch a break again early next week for Monday into Tuesday. The storm system will be close enough on Monday to keep a good amount of cloud cover going, as well as occasionally gusty winds. Temperatures will start in the upper 40s to low 50s, rising to the low 60s at least by the afternoon. Tuesday should feature quite a bit more sunshine, pushing temperatures into the 60s or low 70s. The potential for more active weather to return to the region appears to begin next Wednesday into the latter half of the week, as some quick-moving weather disturbances move through. Now let's turn to the front page of our Courier today. We have two articles to read on that page. The first is titled, "Longtime Tabloid Chief Testifies. Publisher Promised to Suppress Negative Stories in the 2016 Race." This story comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. A veteran tabloid publisher testified Tuesday that he pledged to be Donald Trump's eyes and ears during his 2016 presidential campaign, recounting how he promised the then candidate that he would help suppress harmful stories and even arranged to purchase the silence of a doorman. The testimony from David Pecker was designed to bolster the prosecution's premise of a decades-long friendship between Trump and the former publisher of the National Enquirer that culminated in an agreement to give the candidate's lawyer a heads-up on negative tips and stories so they could be quashed. The effort to suppress unflattering information was designed to illegally influence the election, prosecutors allege, in striving to elevate the gravity of the first trial of a former American president and the first of four criminal cases against Trump to reach a jury. Pecker is the first witness against Trump, who faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with hush money payments meant to prevent harmful stories from surfacing in the final days of the 2016 campaign. Pecker detailed his intimate behind-the-scenes involvement in Trump's rise from political novice to the Republican nomination and the White House. He explained how he and the National Enquirer parlayed rumor-mongering into splashy tabloid stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress steamy stories about Trump, including a porn actor's claim of an extramarital sexual encounter a decade earlier. Pecker traced the origins of their relationship to a 1980s meeting at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, and said the friendship bloomed alongside the success of the real estate developer's TV show, The Apprentice, and the program's subsequent celebrity version. Their ties were solidified during a pivotal August 2015 meeting at Trump Tower involving Trump, his lawyer and personal fixer Michael Cohen, and another aide, Hope Hicks, in which Pecker was asked what he and the publications he led could do for the campaign. Pecker said he volunteered to publish positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. He said he told Trump, quote, "I will be your eyes and ears. I said that anything I hear in the marketplace, if I hear anything negative about yourself, or if I hear about women selling stories, I would notify Michael Cohen," unquote, so that the rights could be purchased and the stories could be killed. Quote, "So they would not get published?" asked prosecutor Joshua Steinglass. Quote, "So they would not get published," Pecker replied. To illustrate their point, prosecutors displayed a screenshot of various flattering headlines the National Enquirer published about Trump, including, quote, "Donald Dominates" and "World Exclusive, the Donald Trump Nobody Knows." The jury was also shown disparaging and outlandish stories about Trump's opponents, including Surgeon Ben Carson and Republican Senator Marco Rubio. Pecker painted Cohen as a shadow editor of the National Enquirer's pro-Trump coverage, directing the tabloid to go after whichever Republican candidate was gaining momentum. Quote, "I would receive a call from Michael Cohen, and he would direct me and direct Dylan Howard which candidate and which direction we should go," Pecker said, referring to the tabloid's then editor. Cohen pleaded guilty in 2018 to federal charges related to his role in the hush money payments. He was once a confidant of Trump's, but their relationship deteriorated in a spectacular fashion. Cohen is expected to be a star government witness, and he routinely posts profane broadsides against Trump on social media. Pecker's testimony Tuesday followed a hearing earlier in the day in which prosecutors urged Judge Juan M. Merchan to hold Trump in contempt and fine him $1,000 for each of 10 social media posts that they say violated an earlier gag order barring attacks on witnesses, jurors, and others involved in the case. Merchan did not immediately rule, but he seemed skeptical of defense arguments that Trump was merely responding in his posts to others' attacks and had been trying to comply with the order. Prosecutors alleged that Trump sought to illegally influence the 2016 race through a practice known in the tabloid industry as catch and kill, catching a potentially damaging story by buying the rights to it and then killing it through agreements that prevent the paid person from telling the story to anyone else. In this case, that included a $130,000 payment to a porn actor, Stormy Daniels, to silence her claims of an extramarital sexual encounter that Trump denies. Prosecutors also described other arrangements, including one that paid a former Playboy model $150,000 to suppress claims of a nearly year-long affair with the married Trump, which Trump also denies. Trump's 34 felony counts arise from reimbursements that prosecutors say Trump's company made to Cohen for hush money payments and that were falsely recorded as legal expenses. The charges are punishable by up to 4 years in prison, though it's unclear whether Merchan would seek to put him behind bars. A conviction would not preclude Trump from becoming president again, but because it is a state case, he would not be able to pardon himself if found guilty. He denies wrongdoing. Much-needed rain fell in Iowa, which kept farmers out of the fields. This written by Courier staff, Dateline Des Moines. Although last week began with above-normal temperatures, multiple storm systems brought cooler temperatures and much-needed rain to Iowa. As a result, farmers across the state only had 3 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to information from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Quote, planters temporarily stopped rolling last week as thunderstorms produced severe weather across portions of Iowa, with above-average rainfall, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy said in a statement. Quote, warmer temperatures are forecasted this week with a more active weather pattern persisting as farmers look for windows of opportunity to get back into the field, unquote. Corn, soybean, and oat planting continued last week when field conditions allowed, the National Agricultural Statistics Service said. Topsoil moisture condition rated 10% very short, 27% short, 60% adequate, and 3% surplus. Subsoil moisture conditions rated 19% very short, 36% short, and 43% adequate, with a 2% showing a surplus. Corn planted reached 13% complete, 3 days ahead of last year and the 5-year average. 8% of expected soybean crop has been planted, 4 days ahead of last year, and 6 days ahead of the average. The first widespread severe weather event occurred early in the reporting period, with all modes of hazards occurring through multiple waves of thunderstorms. At least 15 tornadoes were observed across Iowa, along with large hail and straight-line winds, according to Justin Glisson, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. These thunderstorms brought widespread above-average rainfall as well. Conditions were slightly warmer than average, especially over southern Iowa. The statewide average temperature was 51.6 degrees, and that's 2.2 degrees above normal. Weekly precipitation totals ranged from 0.51 hundredths of an inch in Sac County to 4 inches in Plymouth County. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 1.58 inches, while the normal was 0.91 inches. Winterset in Madison County reported the week's high temperature of 89 degrees on April 14th. That's 29 degrees above average. Elkader in Clayton County reported the week's low temperature of 23 degrees on April 21st. That's 13 degrees below normal. 4-inch soil temperatures were in the mid to upper 40s statewide, with low 50s reported in far southwestern Iowa as of Sunday. Woman charged with murder in party crash. This coming from the Associated Press. A Michigan woman was arraigned on second-degree murder and other charges Tuesday after prosecutors say she drunkenly crashed her SUV into a boat club that was hosting a child's birthday party, killing a young brother and sister and injuring several other people. Marcella Chidester, 66, did not enter a plea to the 8 counts she faces on Saturday's crash at the Swan Boat Club in Monroe County, about 30 miles south of Detroit. During a court hearing that was live-streamed, Chidester's right arm was in a cast from just above the elbow to her fingers. She has been jailed since the crash, and the judge set her bond at the $1.5 million prosecutors requested after relatives of some of the victims asked him to set it at that level. And in arguing for the $1.5 million bond, prosecutor Jeff Yorkey told the court that Chidester had substance abuse issues that were corroborated by her friends and family. Defense attorney Bill Kolovas asked the judge to set Chidester's bond at $100,000. He said she only had a glass of wine and a bowl of chili 4 hours before the crash, and she suffered since November with epileptic-type seizures in her legs. Quote, "This is not a monster," Kolovas said. "It's horrible what happened, but there are some things we don't have control over," unquote. Feds agreed to pay $138 million. Sports doctor sexually assaulted gymnasts for years before his arrest. Story by Ed White of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Detroit. The U.S. Justice Department announced a $138.7 million settlement Tuesday with more than 100 people who accused the FBI of grossly mishandling allegations of sexual assault against Larry Nassar in 2015 and 2016, a time gap that allowed the sports doctor to continue to prey on victims before his arrest. When combined with other settlements, $1 billion now has been set aside by various organizations to compensate hundreds of women who said Nassar assaulted them under the guise of treatment for sports injuries. Nassar worked at Michigan State University and also served as a team doctor at Indianapolis-based USA Gymnastics. He's now serving decades in prison for assaulting female athletes, including medal-winning Olympic gymnasts. Acting Associate Attorney General Benjamin Meiser said Nassar betrayed the trust of those in his care for decades and that the allegations should have been taken seriously from the outset. While these settlements won't undo the harm Nassar inflicted, our hope is that they will give the victims of his crimes some of the critical support they need to continue healing, Meiser said of the agreement to settle 139 claims. The Justice Department acknowledges that it failed to step in. For more than a year, FBI agents in Indianapolis and Los Angeles had knowledge of allegations against him, but apparently took no action, an internal investigation found. FBI Director Christopher Wray was contrite and blunt when he spoke to survivors at a Senate hearing in 2021. The assault survivors included decorated Olympians Simone Biles, Allie Raceman, and Michaela Maroney. Quote, "I'm sorry that so many different people let you down over and over again," Ray said. Quote, "And I'm especially sorry that there were people at the FBI who had their own chance to stop this monster back in 2015 and failed," unquote. After a search, investigators said in 2016 that they found images of child sex abuse and followed up with federal charges against Nassar. Separately, the Michigan Attorney General's office handled the assault charges that ultimately shocked the sports world and led to an extraordinary days-long sentencing hearing with gripping testimony about his crimes. Michigan State University, also accused of missing chances over many years to stop Nassar, agreed to pay $500 million to more than 300 women and girls who were assaulted. USA Gymnastics and U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee made a $380 million settlement. Waverly Shell Rock school officials and law enforcement respond to social media post. Story written by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waverly. A social media post over the weekend prompted a brief investigation by authorities and led to a notice by school officials. Quote, "It's important that you know that we are not aware of any threats having been made toward the school or any individuals," Superintendent Ed Clamforth wrote in a message to Waverly Shell Rock Community School District families. Quote, "Although all indications at this time are that no laws were broken in this instance, we encourage you to remind your students about responsible online behavior and to monitor their social media activity," the message continued. He said school officials are working with law enforcement in the investigation. The Butler County Sheriff's Office looked into the matter. Big Head Burger named one of top 10 burgers in Iowa by the Beef Council. Layla McGee wrote this story. Dateline Waterloo. A local favorite is getting even more recognition, this time from the place it calls home. Big Head Burger in Waterloo has been named one of the top 10 burgers in the state by the Iowa Beef Industry Council. The Ames-based trade organization's competition for the best burger is now in its 15th year, with the 10 finalists determined by public votes. Anonymous judges visit each restaurant to determine the winner, which will be announced next week. The recognition comes months after the restaurant at 324 West 4th Street was chosen to represent Iowa in a Taste of Home magazine listing of best burger in every state. Quote, "Everything is fresh. For one, we grind our own beef. All of our sauces, things that are related to the burger, are of the highest importance to us," said Big Head Burger owner David Bryant. Quote, "We're a burger place, so we take that very seriously, and we do our best to provide as much value as possible to the customer and to put out a fantastic product," unquote. Their most popular burger, Bryant said, is their Western Burger, made with fresh beef, cheddar cheese, onion rings, and the sweet 180 barbecue sauce made by Sioux City native Todd Johns of Plowboys BBQ. Quote, "You get a lot of tanginess from the barbecue sauce, the real richness from the beef, a slight smokiness from the cheese, and a little sweetness from the onion ring. It all rounds out in what we hope is 360 degrees of flavor," Bryant said. Big Head Burger reached the top 10 after a month-long nomination process as a special 15th anniversary edition. All previous Iowa's Best Burger winners were allowed to compete against the newcomers. Bryant said winning the Iowa's Best Burger would mean a lot to him, his restaurant, and the city. And at this point in the article, we have a photograph showing the storefront with a sign above that says Big Head Burger with a cartoon character holding an oversized hamburger bun. Quote, "We're all from up the street, really. The people we employ are from Waterloo, for the most part. It's something good that we can be proud of, and the work that we put in is starting to gain a bit more traction. Either way, we're really appreciative of the people who come in, who spend their hard-earned money, and are kind and gracious, who have an appreciation for what we do," unquote. The Iowa Beef Industry Council will announce the winner on May 1st to kick off Beef Month. Funding identified, schedule solidified for new Cedar Falls School's swimming facility. Andy Malone wrote this story, and the dateline is Cedar Falls. The first swimmers could be in the water at Cedar Falls Community School's new aquatics facility this time next year, according to Superintendent Andy Pettit. Funding has been identified for the remainder of the increase in estimated cost that was first announced nearly 2 years ago. Pettit shared the latest Monday with the Board of Education on the timeline in response to a request for an update from board member R.J. Meyer. The new natatorium is being constructed on the campus of the new high school on West 27th Street, which is slated to open this fall. Officials are working with engineers on the final design and anticipate awarding bids for the second and final phase by the summer, Pettit said. The plan includes a 10-lane competition pool and a shallow 4-lane pool for lessons. The facility will include locker rooms, classroom, and support spaces, along with seating for 500 spectators. The total area is estimated at 38,500 square feet. Estimated costs ballooned nearly 2 years ago from approximately $16 million to between $21 and $22 million. The project was broken into two phases while school officials and a passionate community group, Jump In, were tasked with finding a way to close the gap. The board also approved an agreement formalizing the use of the city's $400,000 community attraction and tourism grant from the Iowa Economic Development Authority. That comes after the Blackhawk County Gaming Association gave $500,000 earlier this year. The school district committed $8.1 million in physical plant and equipment levy funds. After the projected increase in cost, the city increased its contribution from $5.1 million to $8 million. Blackhawk County pitched in $150,000, which was one reason for the successful CAT grant application, Pettit said. The Cedar Falls Health Trust Fund Board gave $25,000. Jump In organizers have raised $3.7 million through 550 contributors, ranging from individuals and businesses to foundations and institutions, according to co-chairs Tracy Malaro and Lorelei Redfern. The initial goal had been $3.3 million. After the school board meeting, Pettit confirmed the district has a grip now on how to cover all of the estimated cost and highlighted Tom and Ginger Penaluna's recent gift of $310,000 as helping to close the remaining gap. Longtime Waverly family business purchased with growth in mind. Andy Malone wrote this story, and the dateline is Waverly. A longtime family-owned company has been acquired with growth, not big changes, in mind. St. Martin's Holdings, Company of Cedar Rapids, announced last week, as first reported by Waverly newspapers, that it has acquired Rada Cutlery. The change comes after the knife company celebrated 75 years of existence since 1948. Quote, "We're super excited and couldn't envision a better fit," said Nick Tabor, president of St. Martin, during a telephone interview. The Rada family has now relinquished control for the first time since Sandra Rada Aleph purchased the business with her late husband Walt back in 1969, according to board chairman Gary Nelson. At that time, it operated in Waterloo as W.C. Gaedtke Cutlery Company. Sandra Rada Aleph, her daughter, Sarah Rada Scott, and son-in-law Thomas Scott were still part of the Rada Manufacturing Company ownership group. Rada Cutlery has close to 100 employees and some 35,000 customers, said Nelson, a family confidant and former CEO of the company. Its loan facility at 905 Industrial Street spans 56,000 square feet and has capabilities of producing 4 million to 5 million knives per year. Phil Jones is its president. Selling was of interest as Nelson and the Radda relatives got older and were looking to spend more time with family. And now, listeners, we'll just take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 24th, and you're listening on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and the print handicapped. Now, let's listen to this announcement.
If you're anxious about retirement, if you can't stop worrying about your aging parents' health, if you're depressed because you feel like you're losing everyone you love, turn to Your Life Iowa. Anxiety and depression are real illnesses. Let us connect you to someone who can help, because mental health is health. Get the help you need to start feeling better at yourlifeiowa.org. We're a free helpline where you can talk, text, or chat 24/7. Brought to you by Iowa HHS.
Now, let's turn to the editorial section. Our first editorial today was printed in the Des Moines Register, written by Randy Evans. Kim Reynolds stretches words meaning with paltry summer food program. Quote, unsustainable is a fascinating word, especially when it is used in government and politics. Merriam-Webster, the dictionary folks, tell us unsustainable means something that cannot be continued or supported. But in government affairs, that definition sometimes gets changed. Instead of something being truly incapable of continuing, the word often means the person using the term simply does not want that something to go forward. Understanding this distinction can help us better parse the statements our politicians make. Here is a real-life example to illustrate this difference. Back in December, Governor Kim Reynolds ended Iowa's participation in a summer food program for low-income families with school-aged children. The governor made the decision even though the bulk of the expense would be paid by the federal government. About 240,000 Iowa children from needy families are affected by her decision. Their parents would have received $40 per month during the summer for each child who qualifies for free or reduced-priced school lunches. The program's purpose was to help these needy families feed their children during the summer when classes are not in session and the kids are not eating at school. In Iowa, the federal government offered $29 million for food assistance this summer. State government would have been responsible for covering $2 million in administrative costs. But in deciding to withdraw Iowa from the program, the governor explained her rationale. Quote, federal COVID-era cash benefit programs are not sustainable and don't provide long-term solutions for the issues impacting children and families, unquote. She also said the program, quote, does nothing to promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become an epidemic, unquote. Last week, the governor unveiled details of a new state grant program to feed needy Iowa kids during the summer month. A total of $900,000 in competitive grants is being offered to communities to expand the reach of two existing summer meal programs, providing meals each weekday through schools, churches, libraries, and community organizations. It's obvious the $900,000 in state grants will not feed as many children as the $29 million in federal summertime assistance would. The money for Reynolds' proposed grants is also coming from the federal government. State Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, a Dubuque Democrat, said the state meal programs Reynolds is expanding spent about $5.8 million last year and fed about 20,000 kids. The Reynolds grants will provide meals for an additional 1,800 kids, he estimated. State Senator Sarah Trone-Garriott, a West Des Moines Democrat, said in a statement last week, quote, the competitive grant program amounts to crumbs for Iowa kids. Governor Reynolds could have accepted $29 million in federal food assistance that would have reached 240,000 children in every corner of the state. The $900,000 state program she announced is tiny by comparison and forces Iowa communities to compete for a sliver of that much smaller pie. It's not enough to meet the real needs facing our state, unquote. The meal sites have inherent problems the summer food benefit cards do not. Families must bring their children to and from the meal sites every day in the summer, which is difficult for most working parents. And Eisenhardt reminded lawmakers 12 counties did not have a meal site last summer, and 21 other counties only had one summer meal site. The summer food program, which operates much like SNAP, the program formerly known as food stamps, was established during the COVID-19 pandemic, when many families' incomes fell because parents had their work hours reduced, or they were laid off, or lost their jobs. Now, although the pandemic is not the economic impediment it once was, the earnings of many families are not keeping up with inflation. That is why the federal government is making the summer food program permanent, although it gave the states the option of dropping out. Iowa joined 12 other states in leaving the program. Nebraska first said it would drop out too, but Governor Jim Pillen, a Republican, ultimately gave in to public pressure and said Nebraska will remain in the federal program. Back to Reynolds' concerns about the federal summer food benefits being unsustainable. The $2.2 million in administrative expenses Iowa state government would have to cover to participate in the federal food program is less than it will cost Reynolds to deploy Iowa State Patrol troopers and Iowa National Guard soldiers to the Texas border with Mexico this spring. And the $29 million price tag for the summer food benefits program is significantly less than the $128 million Iowa state government is paying this year for tuition vouchers for students attending private K-12 schools. 2 years from now, when the voucher program is fully implemented, the vouchers will cost the state treasury an estimated $345 million per year. So, unsustainable really comes down to whether a government official supports or opposes that which supposedly can't be sustained. Randy Evans, the author here, is a retired journalist. Now, from Art Cullen at the Storm Lake Times Pilot, a rushed farm bill is a bad one. A 5-year farm bill was supposed to have been approved last year, but it was held up in the House over disagreements on food stamps, conservation, crop insurance, and funding. House Agriculture Committee Chair Glenn Thompson, a Republican from Pennsylvania, announced last week that he will find a way to push a farm bill out before Memorial Day in order to get President Biden to sign a new farm bill by the end of the year. Don't bet the farm on it. Senator Chuck Grassley said he is pessimistic, and so is Joni Ernst, both Republican Ag Committee members. Representative Randy Feenstra, Republican from Hull, is optimistic. Quote, "So there's going to be a lot of talk, especially when it comes to SNAP and stuff like that. But I fully believe that we will get it out of the House, and then it's just a matter of what Schumer and Stabenow is going to do in the Senate when it comes their way," Feenstra told Brownfield News. If a new farm bill can't pass this year, it is expected that another 1-year extension will be passed. Grassley said farmers would receive protection, but not adequate protection. Getting beyond an extension of the same old would be up to a new Congress, and as of now, it's anybody's guess who will be in charge. It's not as if the existing hang-ups are going anywhere. Fights over food stamps in the House stalled the last farm bill 2 years ago. House Speaker Mike Johnson walks on eggshells in his caucus room as he is accused of caving in to Democrats on spending. The same sticking points will be as sticky in 2025. It's a huge piece of legislation with terribly complicated politics. You have regional interests from the South and Midwest battling over commodity payments. you have disagreements between commodity and livestock interests. Then you throw in cultural wedge issues like food stamps, and it all becomes a mishmash. What used to be a fairly bipartisan process in the past decade has devolved into a food fight like everything else in Washington, because so few know or care about the work of the agriculture committees. Their work is controlled by the interest groups that fund our politics. If food is important, the Farm Bill should be. Our food security and agricultural resiliency are imperiled by a warming climate. A Farm Bill with conservation at its core could serve farmers and the environment better. The Farm Bill as it is, and has been over the past 40 years, has resulted in more consolidation, accelerated rural depopulation, more surface water pollution in Iowa, and fewer farmers. It also has stunted funding for research into livestock disease as pandemics build and bird flu jumps to humans. Putting a new label on a defective product does not make it better, but it might make some politicians look better if they can say they actually got some lipstick applied to the pig. Crop insurance remains intact, as does a safety net for commodity markets. Food stamps, too. As Grassley said, the protections are in place. So instead of jamming through an even worse farm bill than we already have, which is likely in this election year, we may all be better off if we take our time to do it right. Ernst should be the number three Republican in the Senate following the election, and the top woman in the caucus. She could establish herself as a national leader by stating unequivocally that nutrition programs are the most efficient way to fight poverty, which makes all of America stronger. Democrats and Republicans used to join hands over it. Hubert Humphrey and Bob Dole, Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley. Someone needs to be a voice of reason. The ethanol industry, for example, is openly acknowledging that the future for corn growers depends on capturing tax credits for carbon dioxide pipeline. That's not a great position for Iowa farmers to be in, but that is where the current farm bill puts us. We could write a new piece of legislation that enhances soil and water health while directly paying farmers for stewardship. We can make conservation programs a lot more flexible. We can help farmers diversify their revenue streams while cleaning up the Raccoon River, which did not have a nitrate problem before farm programs encouraged planting fence row to fence row. And it could cost less if we cut corporations off the teat, which would have a lot of appeal in Iowa. That is not likely to happen by Memorial Day. More of the same is. Now from the New York Times, The Fantasy of Reviving Nuclear Energy. This was written by Stephanie Cook. World leaders are not unaware of the nuclear industry's long history of failing to deliver on its promises, or of its weakening vital signs. Yet many continue to act as if a nuclear renaissance could be around the corner, even though nuclear energy's share of global electricity generation has fallen by almost half from its high of roughly 17% in 1996. In search of that revival, representatives from more than 30 countries gathered in Brussels in March at a nuclear summit hosted by the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Belgian government. 34 nations, including the United States and China, agreed to, quote, work to fully unlock the potential of nuclear energy, including extending the lifetime of existing reactors, building new nuclear power plants, and deploying advanced reactors. Yet even as they did so, there was an acknowledgement of the difficulty of their undertaking. Quote, nuclear technology can play an important role in the clean energy transition. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, told summit attendees. But she added that, quote, the reality today in most markets is a reality of a slow but steady decline in market share for nuclear power. The numbers underscore that downturn. Solar and wind power together began outperforming nuclear power globally in 2021, and that trend continues as nuclear staggers along. Solar alone added more than 400 gigawatts of capacity worldwide last year, two-thirds more than the previous year. That's more than the roughly 375 gigawatts of combined capacity of the world's 415 nuclear reactors, which remained relatively unchanged last year. At the same time, investments in energy storage technology is rapidly accelerating. In 2023, Bloomberg NEF reported that investors for the first time put more money into stationary energy storage than they did into nuclear. Still, the drumbeat for nuclear power has become pronounced. At the United Nations Climate Conference in Dubai in December, the Biden administration persuaded 24 countries to pledge to triple their nuclear energy capacity by 2050. Those countries included allies of the United States with troubled nuclear programs, most notably France, Britain, Japan, and South Korea, whose nuclear bureaucracies will be propped up by the declaration as well as the domestic nuclear industries they are trying to save. Quote, "We are not making the argument to anybody that this is absolutely going to be a sweeping alternative to every other energy source," John Kerry, the Biden administration climate envoy at the time, said. "But we know because the science and the reality of facts and evidence tell us that you can't get to net zero 2050 without some nuclear. That view has gained traction with energy planners in Eastern Europe who see nuclear as a means of replacing coal, and several countries, including Canada, Sweden, Britain, and France, are pushing to extend the operating lifetimes of existing nuclear plants or build new ones. Some see smaller or more advanced reactors as a means of providing electricity in remote areas or as a means of decarbonizing sectors such as heat, industry, or transportation. So far, most of this remains in the early stages, with only 3 nuclear reactors under construction in Western Europe, 2 in Britain, and 1 in France, each more than a decade behind schedule. Of the approximately 54 other reactors under construction worldwide as of March 23rd, are in China, 7 are in India, and 3 are in Russia, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. The total is less than a quarter of the 234 reactors under construction in the peak year of 1979, although 48 of those were later suspended or abandoned. Even if you agree with Mr. Kerry's argument, and many energy experts do not, pledging to triple nuclear capacity by 2050 is a little like promising to win the lottery. For the United States, it would mean adding an additional 200 gigawatts of nuclear operating capacity, almost double what the country has ever built, to the 100 gigawatts or so that now exists, generated by more than 90 commercial reactors that have been running an average of 42 years. Globally, it would mean tripling the existing capacity built over the past 70 years in less than half the time, in addition to replacing reactors that will shut down before 2050. The Energy Department estimates the total cost of such an effort in the United States at roughly $700 billion. But David Schlechel, a director at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, has calculated that the 2 new reactors at the Votki plant in Georgia, the only new reactors built in the United States in a generation, on average cost $21.2 million per megawatt in today's dollars, which translates to $21.2 billion per gigawatt. Using that figure as a yardstick, the cost of building 200 gigawatts of new capacity would be far higher, at least $4 trillion or $6 trillion, if you count the additional cost of replacing existing reactors as they age out. For much less money and in less time, the world can reduce greenhouse gas emissions through the use of renewables like solar, wind, hydropower, and geothermal power, and by transmitting, storing, and using electricity more efficiently. A recent analysis by the German Environmental Agency examined multiple global climate scenarios in which Paris Climate Agreement targets are met, and it found that renewable energy, quote, is the crucial and primary driver. The logic of this approach was attested to at the climate meeting in Dubai, where more than 120 countries signed a more realistic commitment to triple renewable energy capacity by 2030. There's a certain inevitability about the U.S. Energy Department's latest push for more nuclear energy. The agency's predecessor, the Atomic Energy Commission, brought us Atoms for Peace under Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s in a bid to develop the peaceful side of the atom, hoping it would gain public acceptance of an expanding arsenal of nuclear weapons while supplying electricity, quote, too cheap to meter. Fast forward 70 years, and you hear a variation on the same theme. Most notably, Ernest Monnets, the energy secretary under President Barack Obama, argues that a vibrant commercial nuclear sector is necessary to sustain U.S. influence in nuclear weapons, non-proliferation efforts, and global strategic stability. As a policy driver, this argument might explain in part why the government continues to push nuclear power as a climate solution, despite its enormous cost and lengthy delivery time. China and Russia are conspicuously absent from the list of signatories to the Dubai Pledge to triple nuclear power. Although China signed the declaration in Brussels, China's nuclear program is growing faster than that of any other country, and Russia dominates the global export market for reactors, with projects in countries new to commercial nuclear energy, such as Turkey, Egypt, and Bangladesh, as well as Iran. Pledges and declarations on a global stage allow world leaders a platform to seem to be doing something to address climate change, even if, as is the case with nuclear, they lack the financing and the infrastructure to succeed. But their support most likely means that substantial sums of money, much of it from taxpayers and ratepayers, will be wasted on perpetuating the fantasy that nuclear energy will make a difference in a meaningful time frame to slow global warming. The U.S. government is already poised to spend billions of dollars building new, small, modular, and advanced reactors and keeping aging large ones running. But two such small reactor projects based on conventional technologies have already failed, which raises the question, will future projects based on far more complex technologies be more viable? Money for such projects, provided mainly under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, could be redirected in ways that do more for the climate and do it faster, particularly if planned new nuclear projects fail to materialize. There is already enough potential generation capacity in the United States seeking access to the grid to come close to achieving President Biden's 2035 goal of a zero-carbon electricity sector, and 95% of it is solar, battery storage, and wind. But these projects face a hugely constrained transmission system, regulatory and financial roadblocks, and entrenched utility interests enough to prevent many of them from ever providing electricity, according to a report released last year by the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Even so, existing transmission capacity can be doubled by retrofitting transmission lines with advanced conductors, which would offer at least a partial way out of the gridlock for renewables. In addition to storage, localized distribution and improved management of supply and demand. What's missing are leaders willing to buck their own powerful nuclear bureaucracies and choose paths that are far cheaper, less dangerous, and quicker to deploy. Without them, we are doomed to more promises and wasteful spending by nuclear proponents who have repeatedly shown that they can talk, but they can't deliver. And a note here about the author. Stephanie Cook is a former editor of Nuclear Intelligence Weekly and the author of In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. And now we turn back to local news from the Courier. Waterloo School Board approves budget and increases property tax askings by 7%. Dateline Waterloo. The Waterloo Community School District's property tax collections will increase nearly 7% after Board of Education approved the 2024-25 budget on Monday. The district will collect $40.57 million in property and utility replacement excise taxes for the fiscal year starting July 1st. That is an increase of $2.56 million, or 6.74%, from the current fiscal year. The budget was approved by a vote of 6-1, with at-large board member Lyle Schmidt voting against it. The property tax rate will be $13.98 per $1,000 of taxable value. That is a 62-cent increase from the current tax rate. The district's property tax rates have been decreasing or stagnant for the past 10 years. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 24th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of any of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.